Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Pavi, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it's with ourselves or with others. Across time and culture, stories have been agents of personal transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of our weekly calls is to share stories from incredible changemakers around the globe. Through thoughtfully guided conversations with them, our guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their work, their experiences and insights. Our hope is that these conversations plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society, while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We are thankful to them and to all of our listeners for helping co-create this space. Today, we're grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Jeffrey Mishlove, whose personal journey is not only inspiring, but has had a tremendous impact on many. Thanks again for joining today's call. We'll begin with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into the space. Thank you. And for those just joining us, welcome to our weekly Awaken Call. Today in conversation with Jeffrey Mishlove. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Angela Montano, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A in a circle of sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. The queue is open right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. We have the great pleasure of Angela as our moderator today, and I have the joy of introducing her. Angela is a former broadcast journalist turned international spiritual coach and prayer counselor. She's dedicated her life to sharing the transformative power of prayer, and through her work, she seeks to inspire a new conversation about prayer, teach ancient and new prayer technologies, and encourage people to adopt a prayer practice. Over the past two decades, Angela has facilitated over 15,000 one-on-one prayer sessions with clients of all faiths and belief systems from around the world. She's a skilled speaker, facilitator, writer, and just a beautiful heart in the world. I had the pleasure of participating in a laddership circle with her last year, and the depth of presence and sincerity she brought with her was truly special. It's a joy to have her moderating this conversation today. Over to you, Angela.
Thank you so much, Pavi, and I am so grateful for the space that we're all sharing. As I was preparing today, I just maybe for the first time noticed that our awaken.org logo on the website, kin, the awaken, K-I-N, is highlighted, and I just feel so grateful that we are all kin in our inner transformation as we are doing all that we're doing in the world. So welcome, everyone, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to introduce our extraordinary guest today. We are so fortunate to have Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove with us. He is a licensed clinical psychologist, and he's creator of a provocative program, Thinking Aloud. This is an interview program that explores alternative points of view on topics such as humanistic psychology, living philosophically. He explores frontiers in science, personal and spiritual development, health and healing, mythology, computers and cognition, and much more. In fact, he has interviewed over 200 of the world's leading scholars, researchers, writers, and teachers on these topics. And this Thinking Aloud series has been aired on as many as 120 public television stations in the United States and Canada for more than 18 years. Dr. Mishlove is I love that name, Dr. Mishlove. It makes me think of mischief and love. And as I learn more about him, I think he's been up to some very wonderful mischief related to love. He is the past president of a nonprofit intuition network. You heard that right, nonprofit intuition network. This is an organization dedicated to creating a world in which all people are encouraged to cultivate and apply their inner intuitive abilities. He is also the recipient of a Pathfinder Award from that association for his contributions in the field of human consciousness. Another interesting thing here is that Dr. Mishlove is the recipient of the only doctoral diploma in parapsychology ever awarded it by an accredited university, the University of California in Berkeley. And this is extraordinary and a perfect place to start our conversation, Jeff. I understand that you had a dream, actually a series of dreams in 1972, and you described these dreams as seeming vivid and important. And it sounds to me like these dreams changed the course of your life. Can you tell us what these dreams were, how old you were when you had them, and how they impacted you?
Angela, thank you very much for that warm introduction. And let me just say that it's a pleasure to be with this group. I wasn't aware of the good work that you're doing, but the more I learn, the more I realize that it is very compatible in spirit with my life's work.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1970s, I was in my mid-20s, 21, 22. I was born in 46, so in 1972, I was 26. And at a point in my life where I was trying to determine the direction of my whole life, I was a graduate student in Berkeley in criminology. I was doing field work in San Quentin prison with rapists and murderers. And I wanted very much to change my life at that point. I loved studying human deviance, but I wanted to focus on the positive forms of human deviance. And it was at that time in my life when I had a series of dreams of a psychic nature, and they really motivated me to devote the rest of my life to studying their meaning. And I thought, since today happens to be the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, and although I'm a secular person, I don't consider myself a religious Jew, I'm an ethnic Jew, and this is considered the most sacred day in the whole Jewish calendar. And it turns out that one of the dreams that I had that changed my whole life was also related to this day.
Hmm.
So maybe that would be a good starting point.
Yes. Can you describe the dream? And
yeah. I was dreaming, and my great uncle Harry, whom I hadn't spoken to in over 10 years, appeared to me in my dream, and he touched me very, very deeply, talking to me about my life from his perspective. And when I awoke from the dream, I was singing and crying at the same time, which has only occurred to me once in my lifetime, that time. And the song that I was singing, interestingly, was an old Jewish song that is only sung during the Jewish high holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's called Avinu Malkeinu, and it's about forgiveness. It's about, oh Lord, we're so undeserving, but please forgive us. And I realized that this day, the most sacred day of the Jewish calendar, is all about asking God for forgiveness, which is a very deep and important psychological function. Although it seems like it's a religious function, but I see how it's evolved over over time, which is another long story we can get into if you'd like to go in that direction. But that dream caused me to write home to my parents and say, well, how's Uncle Harry? I just dreamt about him. My mother called me immediately and said, how did you know Uncle Harry has just died? And I, at that point, realized it's as if he was reaching out to me from another realm and trying to touch my life in a deep way that was incomprehensible except through those powerful emotions of singing and crying. But that that world, that you could call it a spiritual world, was more real than real in a sense of the emotional impact that that single dream had on me that has affected my life for nearly half a century since then.
Wow.
And that was one of a series of dreams that guided me in a way to get involved in the media, to create an individual interdisciplinary doctoral program in parapsychology, and so on. And I can tell you this, the simple message that I think your organization can take back from my experience and that I like to leave people with is that, of course, we all have to deal with our own individual destiny, our own individual karma. But when you make a decision to become the best person that you can be, it's as if the heavens will reach out to help you. Because that seems to be what is desired from that realm of, let's call it, higher consciousness.
Beautiful. And I love the way you just phrased that, the decision to be the best person you can be or the best version of the person you can be. Because I have a feeling many of us are kind of wanting to be that, and yet making that decision, it does seem like it brings it to a much more kind of vivid possibility. Well, how extraordinary that your Uncle Harry came to you in a dream, and that what interests me too about this is, what about you was able to listen so deeply and take this in to your being in the way that you did, that allowed you to shift the course of your life? Because many people might have a dream about someone during their time of transition or passing, and they just let that dream go. They may tell it as a story at a family function. It sounds like it was this experience of singing and crying. It occurred to you in such a visceral way.
Yeah, it was more real than real is probably the best way that I can explain it. And at that point, I knew there was just something else. And then I wrote back to my mother or spoke to her on the phone and asked, can I please have something that belonged to Uncle Harry so I can remember him by? And they sent me a little book and said this was Uncle Harry's favorite book. Now, by that time, the truth is, I was primed. I had done my undergraduate senior honors major at the University of Wisconsin in psychology on the psychology of religious mysticism. And I started that project as a skeptic, thinking I will begin to explore all the psychopathologies involved in people thinking that they see ghosts or have a mystical experience. And as I began exploring it, I realized that these were among the best and brightest people in our society, and that the experiences turned out to be quite positive for them and even backed up in the scientific literature. So I had by that time, as an undergraduate, come to that realization. So when the dream came from Uncle Harry, it was sort of telling me, get back on track with your life. This is your destiny right then and there.
I so appreciate this conversation, because I have a feeling with listeners that these experiences, that the one that you described, are probably more common than we think they are. Like, just listening to you, I'm thinking about my grandfather. And my grandfather had been an alcoholic, and he drank on the weekends, and he didn't miss work. He worked during the week, but this caused a great deal of strife in the marriage between my grandmother and my grandfather. My grandfather had a dream that his father, who had passed, was standing above him, and my grandfather felt himself being taken. He was in quicksand, and he was going under. And he held his hand up to his father, and he said, "If you lift me up, I will not take another drink." His father took his hand. He was pulled out of the quicksand. He woke up in a great, like, sweat, and he never had a drink again. It's extraordinary. What do you think makes people available to these?
What a wonderful story, and it makes really the same point as my Uncle Harry's story, that sometimes you could say spiritual energy reaches out to us from beyond the veil and helps us put our life in a new direction.
Yeah, and I wonder how we become more available to those messages. I think of myself, you know, sadly, I feel like in some ways I've been on a, you know, I don't know if it's sadly or good, but like a lifelong self-improvement plan, you know, mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like I'm beating my head against the wall, you know, trying to improve this or, you know, become more disciplined in that. And, you know, I wonder how anyone like myself or relates to a perpetual kind of efforting, how might we make ourselves available from a, you know, from that kind of gift that your Uncle Harry gave you or my
Well, I can tell you this. Once I began to enter into my doctoral program in parapsychology, I faced enormous opposition. There were elements of society that felt that major universities shouldn't give degrees in parapsychology. And in fact, I'm the only person ever to get one. But the key is to be willing to persevere. Once you're on the path, you're going to face obstacles. There's going to be a lot of resistance. You're going to be discouraged from time to time. And, you know, sometimes you have to do other things. Like you talked about the television series I did. At one time, we were on 120 stations all over North America. I went for a period of from 2002 until 2015, about 13 years, where I wasn't doing any television interviews at all until I restarted the New Thinking Aloud series in 2015. So, you know, sometimes we deviate from the path, or our unique path pulls us in another direction for a while.
I've often thought that we have to have more faith in the ebb and flow of life. You know, we kind of want it all going forward in a way we understand, but this undulation is maybe part of the journey in and of itself.
And the obstacles that we face in life are very important for us.
Tell me more about that.
One of my mentors was Arthur M. Young, and he was the inventor of the Bell helicopter. Back in 1947, he was like the man of the year. And after becoming rich and famous, he began delving into esoteric thinking, spirituality, and metaphysics. And at one point, he asked me, what do you think is the philosopher's stone in alchemy? Now, the philosopher's stone is the key catalyst that alchemists use in order to turn lead into gold. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, the philosopher's stone, those are the obstacles that you face in life. When you deal with those obstacles, you are turning the lead of your soul into gold.
Mm. What a beautiful reframe for obstacles. That is very powerful. Thank you. Mm. Would you tell us what the field of paranormal psychology is, and how did you even know about it to put forward this proposal to be to achieve a doctoral, to receive a doctorate in it?
Mm-hmm. Well, It's a well-established field. In 1882, the Society for Psychical Research was formed in London, and similar societies in Paris and in Germany and in the United States. And some of the world's leading scientists were involved in that time, and it was at a period in human history when spiritualism was a huge fad. Much the way the consciousness movement is a big social movement today, it was spiritualism at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, and they began conducting case studies of great spiritualist mediums to determine whether science could validate what they were doing. And as a result of that, they determined after a lot of research that, well, it's very, very difficult to prove life after death, but what we can be sure of, minimally speaking, is what they call thought transference or telepathy. Definitely, lots of evidence for that. And the single most common psychic experience that people reported is what you and I just spoke about regarding Uncle Harry's death. It's called a crisis apparition when the death of a loved one occurs, or a person you love is in a crisis, like an accident or something. They will appear to other people in their dreams and visions. Very, very common experience. Then, in the 1930s, Professor J.B. Rhine at Duke University began doing experimental research with card-guessing experiments to prove the existence of ESP. In the 1960s, the Parapsychological Association was formed, and it became affiliated in 1969 formally with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So in the early 70s, when I created my doctoral degree in parapsychology, naturally I had access to all of this information at the university libraries. There's really, you know, huge amounts of data, hundreds and hundreds of case studies and experimental studies had already been published in the literature. It's kind of disappointing to me the way this information is so important. So many people want to know about what can science tell us regarding consciousness and spirituality and spiritual realms. And this data largely exists within the proceedings and archives of the various parapsychology and psychical research and investigations that have been going on for 150 years.
Wow. And when you, speak about, you know, it's disappointing to you that this information hasn't, gotten out there or is recognized more. I mean, it is kind of phenomenal that no one before or since you has done doctoral work in this field. I mean,
well, we should be precise. Hardly, they've done doctoral work. They haven't received a diploma parapsychology.
Right, right.
About maybe 200 people who have actually done a doctoral level research projects on parapsychological topics.
Yes. And so as you find this information so valuable, help me understand how it is valuable in relationship to how we live our lives. I think of many people thinking of, the paranormal as a, interesting cocktail conversation or a dinner conversation.
Mm-hmm. Wait, but you use the word paranoia, and I think that's important.
Oh, that's interesting. I used that word?
You did. You said it. It was a slip of the tongue. And it's true. Some people get very paranoid, and we run into this all the time. People have garden variety psychic experiences, and then they worry, am I going insane? Because there's so little education in our culture.
Yeah. I feel like I can hardly say the word because I don't ever say the word, paranormal, psychology. The question I'm trying to get out is, why is this, how does this subject enable us to live our lives in a more joyful, rich, and service-oriented way?
That's a very good question. I think the answer is going to be a little different for each person.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you, for example, in my world, I run into some people who have a calling, And it might be, for example, to do clairvoyant work with police departments. Mm-hmm. And that's a very specialized area, and if somebody feels called to do it, they're going to need a support system to work through. So other people may feel that they have a natural talent as a healer. Then I'm sure you know many people like that, or people who become part of a program like the Centers for Spiritual Living, where I teach the parapsychology course that's a requirement for ministers in training in that religion, because they, in the course of their ministerial practice, are going to run into a wide variety of people experiencing paranormal phenomena who are going to need some comforting or are going to need some counseling. And so it's important to understand the background information of parapsychology very much the way you'd want a liberal arts education and want to be a bit familiar with English literature and poetry and because this is part of being a well-rounded, well-educated person.
And as I listen to you, it's occurring to me that it validates the human experience in its wholeness without kind of chopping off things that, you know, that don't fit some box that our culture, you know, that some of us are encaged in. And there's something very space creating in having this conversation with you that I hope we can all take into our day.
Well, everybody is curious, I think, about the nature of their own consciousness. How deep does it extend? How far does it go? And parapsychology has a great deal to say about that.
Beautiful. It sounds like there's a great deal of strength to be drawn from that. I want to go back to something you said, Jeff, in your when you were first speaking about this being the highest holy day in the Jewish faith, Yom Kippur, and it being a holiday related to forgiveness. Here in Los Angeles, our mayor is actually the first elected Jewish mayor, and he spoke about this, I happened to hear. And he described this day as a gift of a new beginning. When you, from the viewpoint of the Jewish faith, have a chance to forgive yourself and others. And I was surprised when you and I spoke yesterday just for a brief chat about the focus of this interview. I was thinking about all these extraordinary interviews you've done, and I viewed some of your YouTube Thinking Aloud videos that are extraordinary, and I highly recommend people tune into them. Because what you're having conversations with people about, it's truly new. When I was a television news reporter, I did 1 year of that, and the next year I couldn't believe there was nothing new. It was political corruption, really, you know, there was just, it seemed different faces and names, but it somehow didn't seem to evolve. And when I see these interviews you're doing, it's evolving me as I'm listening because I'm hearing something truly new. So I appreciate that. So when I thought about what you'd want to talk about, I'm thinking, you know, these, you know, frontiers in science, you know, mythology, global awareness, and when I ask you, you said, well, I think I'd like to focus on forgiveness, and I was really surprised and taken aback, and how does your work in all that you do bring you to forgiveness, and what have you learned
about it? I'm trying to be mindful of the energy of the day itself, and as a person, a Jewish ethnic heritage, the energy of forgiveness is very powerful today. And if you read the Bible, you'll see that in ancient times, what the Jewish people did to forgive themselves was what we call the scapegoat. They sort of projected all their sins onto a goat and sent it out into the wilderness. And that was a way of expiating themselves from their sins. And then later, in the rabbinical period, we develop prayers like the Avinu Malkeinu song I referred to, which is a prayer, Our Father, Our King, we are so unworthy, but please, You, forgive us. And then I think about my Christian friends and how, as a young child, of course, I learned the Lord's Prayer like other young Christian children did at the YMCA camp. And the prayer goes, you know, forgive us our sins as we forgive the sins of others. So then I think with the Lord's Prayer in Christianity, the concept of forgiveness became like turn the other cheek, forgive the other person. Don't just ask God to forgive you. But now, in the present era, you referred to it earlier, we're in an era where we learn to forgive ourselves, which is a spiritual process. And I think as people come to forgive themselves, they become clear, they open up, and psychic functioning becomes more available. That's the connection.
I think this is interesting. Psychic functioning becomes more available.
It's said in the Yoga Sutras, for example, that when you meditate, you calm your mind and it becomes like the quiet surface of a lake and it can reflect perfectly the surroundings of the lake. But when the mind is agitated, then it's like a rippled surface and it doesn't reflect very well at all. So what agitates the mind often is at a deep level are those places where we have not forgiven ourselves. The ancient Egyptians had a similar idea. If you want to enter into the temple of Osiris, or into the paradise of Osiris, I should say, according to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, you have to answer all of these questions. Did you sin this way? Did you lie that way? Did you steal? Did you do all of these things? And you have to answer them from the position of, no, I never did any of those things, which, of course, will not be true for any human being. But if you've forgiven yourself for everything, then you enter into the heaven of Osiris with a clear heart.
And what has your personal path of forgiveness been like? As you study this as a scholar and you're seeking to make it, you know, your own experience, what has been the...
Well, you know, it's probably not so different from yours. I'm a human being like everybody else, and although I am not, as I mentioned, I'm not a religious person, as this season came around, I began to think about people who might still feel that I've done something to them that they hold a grudge against, and I've reached out to try and mend relationships with people like that. It's a normal human process, and you know, I learn every day, I think just as you and everyone listening does.
Well, that's interesting that you've reached out. I think some people think of forgiveness as something you do kind of in just yourself. I forgive them, and you know, I hope that they forgive me. But reaching out is an act of courage, it's an act of vulnerability, and through reaching out to make peace, what does that achieve for you?
Whether the 12-step program deals with this, I think, very well when they talk about the necessity to make amends. Sometimes reaching out is important, but sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes if you've hurt another person, you need to do what you can to correct the damage you may have caused.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As you delve deeper in the field of paranormal psychology, and if you had one thing to inform us of today, what would it be that would enable us to go forward more available to being forgiven and to forgiving others? What would help us forgive? I think of Martin Luther King, who said, forgiveness is an attitude, not an event.
You know, I suppose you brought up and highlighted the word earlier, the word decision. We make a decision to become the best person we can be. And as part of that decision, we want to naturally forgive others, be forgiven by others, and forgive ourselves. It's all kind of part and parcel of that decision. Now, it doesn't happen immediately. In my own case, for example, I'm still working on creating a wholeness and forgiveness from some traumatic events that occurred half a century ago. Sometimes we need to be patient. It doesn't happen all at once. But if the commitment is there, things unfold in time, in kind of in a natural way.
Yeah. I'm interested in what you said when you spoke about this day being Yom Kippur, and you said the energy of the day, there's an energy of forgiveness today.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really offering us the opportunity to tune into that energy today, whether we were raised Jewish or not. You're suggesting to us that that's available to us, yes?
Yes, my opinion is that every human being today inherits as their birthright all of the world's spiritual treasures, whether Jewish or Arabic or Buddhist or Zoroastrian. This is now the inheritance of humanity.
And how might we attune to this energy of forgiveness today? What would serve us in opening our consciousness to this?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, It's a funny thing about your question. It's as if you're asking me what's the recipe,
mm-hmm.
And in a way, forgiveness. At least my experience is it doesn't hurt to try and follow a recipe, to be honest. But what the recipe will do, it might be just to sit and read a good book, or to sit and think about people who you would like to forgive, or people whom you would like to be forgiven from or by. But at the end of the day, it's a process that bubbles up from within. It's the recipe might serve as a catalyst or a trigger, but it has to come from deep within in order to be authentic. It's not something that you can make yourself do, even if you think you should do it. That's
right.
Not enough.
And what I'm hearing you say is forgiveness really comes from our being. It comes mm-hmm. from a non-doing aspect of us. And when we dwell there, we may do something like you did. You call this person, or you maybe speak a prayer of forgiveness. But it comes deep within, and it's occurring to me, perhaps for anyone on the call that is inspired or so moved, maybe what we do is we intend to allow forgiveness, the energy of forgiveness, thoughts about forgiveness, to be a priority today. I think Yeah, I think for myself, there may be people I need to forgive, or maybe I could reach out to be forgiven, but, you know, I'm busy because I've got the dishes to do, the laundry, I've got to go here, go there, and then none of that is more important than forgiveness, but my mind tells me the doing is more important than the non-doing,
mm-hmm.
and then the most sacred activity of my consciousness goes not attended to.
That's a risk. But even if you have a fleeting thought like, gee, it'd be nice if I had a conversation with so-and-so, I'll do it next week. That's not bad. That's a start.
Yes, that's a beautiful way to say it. That's
mm-hmm.
a start.
Mm-hmm.
When you spoke about this shift, when you wanted to go from studying deviant activities of human and mm-hmm. humans, and in criminology you were studying those things related, I'm assuming, to some kind of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said you wanted to study positive deviant aspects of humans, what are some of those? And do you even consider forgiveness to be deviant? Do you think that we mostly hold on to grudges as human beings? Or do you think, no, we're really, as a species, very forgiving?
Well, I think we're both. And I'm reminded of the debate that takes place in the Bible, where I'm not a Christian, but I respect the words of Jesus. And he says, "You have heard an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, no, resist not evil. If a man smites you on the cheek, turn the other cheek." That's the debate. And today, the president of the USA is very public about the fact he's very big on vengeance, not on forgiveness. So it's an ongoing debate. And in many circles, it's, for example, I happen to have a very good friend, a person who I've interviewed extensively on the New Thinking Aloud channel and to great acclaim, but who is being accused of being a Nazi. And some people say that's unforgivable. It doesn't matter how nice he seems, how humanistic he seems, you can never trust a Nazi. So, you know, can you forgive Hitler, for example? That's a tough one. I haven't yet to meet a person who says, "I forgive Hitler."
Or, "I forgive Donald Trump,"
mm-hmm.
for those who are really challenged by his, you know, vengeful rhetoric.
And, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And many people say, you don't want to forgive. And you know, this should never be considered normal. There's a point to that. I don't think forgiveness ever should occur prematurely. It needs to occur at the right time and the right place, but sooner or later it needs to occur.
I wonder about, I was working with a client who was just losing so much equanimity, peace, through and by, because of the election. And one of the things that came up in our work together was to imagine him as a little baby and to rock him and to soothe him and see if that would be a way into forgiveness. So that was very effective for her. She cried and cried. But she really began to have compassion for him as a human being. So whether whomever one is trying to forgive, if it's difficult to even imagine a person's innocence, sometimes regarding one's infancy is a way to start as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not just people in high office. Our country is becoming so polarized right now that the latest statistic I read is that 50% of Republicans would oppose their child ever marrying a Democrat, and 30% of Democrats feel the same way about Republicans.
That does not surprise me today.
Yeah, it suggests that the country has some forgiving to do, some mending of offenses. I know for myself it's been difficult, but I have resolved that I am not going to lose any friendships over politics right now.
And that is a profound choice in and of itself. And as people struggle to build bridges, this idea of nonviolence, this idea of forgiveness, is one that really speaks to the heart of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And how does our, you know, I feel it as I say it, but I feel like the more we recognize that more is going on than meets the eye, the more, you know, we are more than we think we are, it sometimes softens those lines of division. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up the term nonviolence a moment ago. in relationship to forgiveness. And this is something, as a nonviolent person myself, and frankly, as a pacifist and a nonviolent protester, a nonviolent objector during the Vietnam period, I have strong feelings about it. And yet, one of our greatest spiritual documents, the Bhagavad Gita, takes an opposing point of view, in part when it, you know, Arjuna, the great warrior in this poem, doesn't want to go into battle against his own cousins, but his charioteer, who turns out to be the god Krishna, tells him, you know, you have a duty to go into battle, and furthermore, the soul is infinite. You didn't create it, and you can't destroy it, so you should do your duty. It almost seems as if it's arguing in favor of violence, or at least in favor of taking a detached attitude, where you realize that there is a cosmic perspective that goes beyond matters of life and death and politics and the sorts of things that interest us from our earthly plane.
How do you rectify that for yourself as a pacifist, as you say, a nonviolent person, when you think of Arjuna and he is called into battle? How do you
You're getting into some very deep issues, Angela, and I wrestle with this one.
Mm-hmm.
For me, again, it comes to forgiveness and to tolerance, that I'm a nonviolent person, but should I be intolerant of people who don't hold that point of view?
Mm-hmm.
I think I can respect a person who differs from me in this regard.
Yes.
There are those who argue that the only way to stand up against intolerance is to become intolerant of those who are intolerant. But to me, that's too paradoxical. It doesn't work well. I think a certain level of tolerance, even towards those who are intolerant, is necessary.
Mm-hmm. To draw the greater circle around all of humanity. You know.
Yeah, I mean, we all have our weaknesses. We all have our bad moments, and at some level, maybe it's a good idea to be able to forgive, for example, Hitler or any of the other great violent people of history.
Well, one of my favorite forgiveness prayers is a Buddhist prayer of forgiveness, and one of the lines is, you know, for anyone who's caused me any harm, either knowingly or unknowingly through their own confusions, I forgive them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love the line about confusions, because I know I'm confused, you know,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps our violence towards each other comes from a very deep confusion. I find it interesting that our conversation has gotten to this place, and I would say it's this place of paradox, because as I read more about you in researching your extraordinary body of work for this call, I just kept getting to, you are drawn to the paradox, that even as you seek to provide an objective view about paranormal psychology and to truly provide something objective for those who believe as well as those who consider themselves non-believers, at the same time, you even challenge what is sometimes called the myth of objectivity, that as human beings, we are subjective, and so even as you're attempting this, you're also shining the light on, is it even possible to be objective at all?
Well, you love to go deep, don't you? Since it's Yom Kippur, let me share with you a day that I decided, in spite of the fact that I was a secular person, I would observe this holiday. And so I got all the Jewish prayer books, and I sat home by myself, fasting, which Jews do today, mm-hmm. and reading the different prayers. And I found myself unmoved by almost all of them. They seem too conventional, like, oh, dear God, slay our enemies and then forgive us. But one prayer from the Reconstructionist Jewish prayer book really moved me, and it was a poem in which the poem goes, one day the Spirit of God came and breathed the breath of life into the bones of all of those who perished in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And the Lord said, wake up, wake up. And the bones spoke back to God, and they said, no, we won't wake up. Why should we wake up for you now when you weren't with us when we needed you? And that poem pierced me to the core. Mm. I think the message sometimes is that we need to confront God mm-hmm. or our vision of God. Mm-hmm. To me, that's what authentic Judaism is about, is wrestling with God, not taking any of the maxims and memes associated with God for granted.
That's a beautiful invitation to us all. It makes me think of a phrase in the Bible, fight the good fight, let love be your greatest aim. And I think the whole concept of nonviolence could be used by my ego just to avoid conflict, to avoid confrontation, to avoid uncomfortability. And you're really calling us to be, you know, awake to, you know, to such a, maybe it's only in this place that you're describing for us, you know, why should we, challenging God, that we really truly transform. That we really transform.
And it strikes me that in every age there are ideas that are associated with the prevailing deities that must be challenged by people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know why I'm thinking about this, but when I was a teenager, there was a terrible crime that occurred, and I think it was like 7 nurses got kidnapped by this one man. And they, as the story goes, one of the nurses said, we've got to fight back, fight back. And the other said, no, just do what he says, you know. And the one who wanted to fight found a way to hide. And this person murdered all the other nurses. And the only one who wanted to resist was the one who survived. And my mother was very affected by this. And she talked to my sister and I at length about this. If you're ever in danger, fight, fight, fight. If somebody tries to get you in a car, fight, fight, fight. And she was, you know, and I don't know why I'm thinking of this as you're talking, but it's like, and I too consider myself very interested in nonviolence, as is our service space community and our awaken mm-hmm. call. So mm-hmm. it does...
Well, I think what you mean by fight does not necessarily imply violence. It implies to me never giving up.
Yes, yes.
But that can be done in a peaceful way, too.
Yeah, yeah. But to understand the difference between peaceful and playing nice, oh, this will never happen, delusion, denial, you know, it's just an interesting edge for me and many of us to inquire about in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I so appreciate your sharing, and I invite Pavi into our conversation. Beloved Pavi.
Sorry, I was on mute. Thank you so much, Angela and Jeffrey. Yeah. It's been a fascinating conversation so far, and I just wanted to take a moment to invite our listeners to, if they have a question, to be added to the queue, just press *6. If you'd like to send it in by email, you can email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. Jeff, I had a question in the meantime that I wanted to ask. Just, I was really struck by the work you've done around intuition. And I think we all, just being human, we all have a sense of what that, you know, what that word means, and maybe examples from our own lives of where we've tuned into it. But I was interested in knowing, how do you define intuition, and what role do you think it can play in deepening our transformation?
Oh, thank you for the question, Pavi. To me, intuition comes from a Latin word, intuere, and it really just means inner knowing, knowing that comes somehow from within. So it includes a broad category of different experiences, but in the largest sense, let me put it this way, in the psychology of Carl Jung, there are four major psychological functions: thinking, feeling, sensing, and intuition. And it strikes me that our culture is one that highly emphasizes thinking and sensing, with less emphasis on intuition and feeling. So we're out of balance in that sense. And the work of the Intuition Network, by helping people become more in touch with and feel more legitimate regarding their inner experiences, to help restore some of the missing balance.
That's so interesting. I think one of the questions that comes up for me is how does one distinguish what is a true intuition and what may just be a conditioning speaking? Or a fear, or a, you know.
That is a very delicate question. And my first answer would be, well, this is what the science of parapsychology does. We apply the scientific method. We look for empirical evidence so that if somebody has a vision that seems to be of a psychic or intuitive nature, and let's say it's about the future and it's recorded in advance, then we can compare that recording with events as they transpire in the future, and on the basis of that, we can make a judgment as to how intuitive or psychic an individual is in a particular instance. There's data that we can go on. But in the real world, that's usually not possible. People get intuitions all the time about what is right and wrong, and we don't have time to always check to make sure that the data is exactly in alignment with our views of things, or maybe the data is simply not available, but we have to make a decision. So one can say that some people are very gifted at this. They seem to have a knack of making the right decision in the absence of evidence, and that would be a sign of intuition to me.
Thank you. I have more questions, but I am going to pass on. We have a caller in the queue, so I'm going to hand over to her.
Hi, Dr. Mishlove, and hi, everybody. My name is Mish, and I'm calling you from Brooklyn, New York. And first, I'd like to thank you for sharing yourself with us today. It's a very special call for me. Your call reminded me of a dream that I had back in the 70s, shortly after my father passed away. He came to me in a dream, and he apologized to me. We loved each other, but we had a very difficult relationship in some ways. And he apologized to me, and out of this dream came healing. We forgave each other. And when I woke up out of the dream, the hairs on my arms were standing up on edge. And this call is also special for me because I'm also a secular Jew. We also happen to be around the same age. And I studied at the New York School of Spiritual Science back in the 70s, parapsychology. I don't know if you're familiar with the Reverend Diane and Stephanie Nagorka.
No, I'm not.
Okay, so I was excited, I guess, on an ego level when I saw your name was Mish Love. I was like, oh, Mish, you know. but I'm just, like, so excited, and I feel very blessed. And the fact that it's Yom Kippur and you brought back this dream of forgiveness between my father and I, and just thank you so much for sharing yourself with us today.
Well, thank you. That was a beautiful story. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mish. Jeff, I wanted to ask about this idea of, you know, when people have these experiences, they can be powerful. I imagine they can also be frightening for a lot of people. And we interviewed a few years ago a man named Phil Borges, who's a very gifted photographer who spent a lot of time with indigenous communities. And he talked to a lot of medicine men from the communities, and he would ask them, like, where did your journey begin on this path? And he found a common thread where for many of them it would come with this sort of a, almost like a breakdown experience, what might be defined in the Western world as like a psychotic episode. And yet it would be at that point that an elder from the community would step forward and guide them, you know, through this process and say, this is a gift, and this is a responsibility, and this is, you know, how you hold this. And and I'm wondering if there, you know, what happens to people who may not have that kind of guidance? And is there something, are there resources for them now?
There are resources, but I can say overall our culture is out of balance, and we don't have the resources that other cultures do have. And as a consequence, there are many people who are mistreated when they report psychic experiences, and so some of their paranoia and fears about these experiences are legitimate. They may be diagnosed with mental illness, they may be given drugs or other forms of therapy that are inappropriate to them. Those are very real possibilities. On the other hand, there are many different networks that are available to people who have these experiences. Some of them are in the context of yoga and a phenomenon that in the yoga tradition might be referred to as kundalini experiences that people have that can be, you know, disturbing forms of psychic experience, and they have ways of treating it in the context of their traditions that work well. There are other methods of addressing these things. If you look, you know, there is I guess you could call it an underground network of esoteric culture where various remedies exist. Some of them are really not good remedies either, because on the other side, there's the risk of superstition and exploitation as well.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope, I'm sure. I'm going to hit the pause on my questions and go to our next caller here.
Hi, Jeffrey. It's David Crozier.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
This is great. Really appreciate it, particularly your reflection about with the bones, no, I won't wake up. It's still reverberating, and I'd say as a secular-ish Jew, you're talking a lot like the rabbi I wish I had growing up. Anyways, I've got a couple lighter questions for you. You've interviewed a lot of different folks. If there was maybe one or two people who you couldn't have interviewed because, you know, they'd been passed away before you would have had a chance, who might you have liked to interview, and what have you liked to ask them?
Well, what an interesting question. Thank you for that. And the first name that pops into my mind is Pitirim Sorokin, who died, as I recall, in 1968, just before I started doing interviews. And he was a fascinating man and a great inspiration to me. He is the author of a book called, several books. One is called The Crisis of Our Age. Another book is Social and Cultural Dynamics. And he wrote about the nature and power of love. And he looked at all of human history and began looking at the ways love affected human history. And for example, he cites the case of the Emperor Ashoka, who was an Indian emperor and a warrior. And he created a big empire through military conquests. But then he converted to Buddhism, and he became nonviolent. He just told all his soldiers to come home, and he ruled the kingdom peacefully. And it's one of the only examples in history of a warrior ever putting down his armies. So I wish I had had the opportunity to meet Sorokin and interview him and talk to him about, you know, the great spiritual moments in human history, because that was one of his areas of expertise.
Another lighter question, hopefully relative, is your thoughts on, I've observed when people seem to have enlightenment experiences that happen quickly versus gradually in different backgrounds, there seem to be a host of problems with some of the Eastern ones. It seems like there's, you know, sort of an overload of Kundalini, which turns into, there's been some well-reported problems with that in the Western. It seems like it can lead to types of fundamentalism and so forth. And it's a conundrum because it, you know, in either case, it's based in an enlightenment type of process, but leading to some, you know, a little bit unhealthy type of things. Do you have any thoughts on that dynamic?
It strikes me, David, that there are traps at every point along the way on a spiritual journey. Every moment of enlightenment also has a dark side. It could get flipped and turned into just the opposite with only the slightest subtle movement. Something of good intention can allow a certain negative energy inside of it. That's part of the human condition. It strikes me, and it's an important reason why we need to be forgiving of ourselves, I think, because these things are sort of inevitable. I've had the opportunity of interviewing actually many people who were recognized spiritual masters, and in my experience, for the most part, is not too hard to see them, you know, having expressions of petty jealousy or anger or something that would appear to be some sort of, you know, egotistical activity of the sort that most people engage in.
That's actually a very healthy, humbling type of perspective to think about it like that. Anyways, I very much appreciate you sharing on the call today. It's a pleasure to listen in.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Jeff, I wanted to ask a little bit about your work with, you know, studying, like, the book that you wrote, Encyclopedic in Its Depth, The Roots of Consciousness. And I just wanted to ask a little bit about, when did your interest in consciousness first kind of, do you have the memory of like when that first, the mystery of consciousness kind of came up for you?
As a matter of fact, in The Roots of Consciousness, I, in the introduction of the original edition from 1975, I remembered a moment from my childhood when I was about 10 years old. And I did the strangest thing. I don't know why I did it. I climbed up on the rooftop of our house, took off all my clothes, and I just sat up there. And I was thinking to myself, why am I me? I could look out over the city and see there are many other houses and many other people, but I was in this body and this house and this city, and how'd that happen? And I, for me, that's sort of where it started. I began just questioning, like, what's going on here?
Yeah. It's one of those mysteries in plain sight, it feels like. This question of consciousness. And I'm curious, like, over the decades that you've been studying this, what are some of the key things that you feel like you've learned?
Well, I suppose it's fair to say that my career in parapsychology has had certain specialties. And I think in my case, as I look back on it, one of the most intriguing specialties is that I seem to get involved in the most bizarre cases available, where things are happening that just seem absolutely unbelievable and are mixed up with all sorts of stories about UFOs and things appearing and disappearing in thin air and things of that sort. So for me, one of the most important lessons that I try to bring to my work and impart on people is to develop a level of toleration of things that seem bizarre and inexplicable, and don't just try and shove it under the rug and pretend it doesn't exist, because it's there and it is begging us to finally start to deal with it.
Yeah, that reminds me of your work with the other book, was it called the PK Man?
The PK Man, yes, it's all about that, those kinds of unbelievably bizarre, strange, large-scale phenomena.
What drew you to work on that?
Well, maybe it was naivety, or maybe it's just a certain intuition. I've always kind of intuited, I think, that UFO phenomena are important. And even as a child, as like a 10-year-old child, I was getting books out of the public library on UFOs and writing to the authors and getting letters back even. And I've just always felt that if you want to understand the questions of life after death, if reincarnation, ESP, telepathy, and the nature of human consciousness, you might as well begin to look at the question of extraterrestrial intelligence. Because look out at the universe. We are in a tiny planet around a tiny star in an average galaxy that has millions of similar stars and planets in it, and there are billions of other galaxies. The universe must be full of consciousness. And for me, I guess, and maybe it's just unique to my personality, being a Sagittarius or something, that I feel a pull coming from the universe. Other people feel a pull coming from the earth itself. Many people are much more earthy, but I feel drawn to, you know, what's going out there, going on out there in the planets and stars and the vastness of space. We are so tiny, but in a way we're so large at the same time, because you know, the universe is infinitely smaller than we are. That is, you can go to infinitesimally smaller measurements and sizes, even smaller than atoms and quarks, or larger. You can get as big as the whole universe, and maybe there are multiverses out there. But it just seems that there's so much more going on than is available here on the planet. And of course, the planet itself is incredibly complex. One can live many, many, many lifetimes just studying all of the languages and cultures and stories that are available here on the planet.
It's beautiful. As you're talking, I'm thinking about, like, the importance in your work of keeping the mind open and to accepting, you know, all possibilities. and it relates to one of the comments that came in, or reflections that came in for you from one of our listeners. And he says, when I follow the advice to always have the beginner's mind, I am open to see and learn and respond to what's happening in and around me. And I experience the roots of consciousness and its flowers. The important thing for me is to be open to what is rather than to see my thinking or prejudices or preconceptions. When I am seeing what is, I'm in the present and I'm focused on process rather than trying to make or find a particular outcome. And I found that to be constructive and deeply satisfying.
Mm-hmm. And I second that. That's all very well put.
In your work and in the interviews and in the countless people you must have met through your journey, have you ever found someone whom you felt like held these psychic or para, you know, normal abilities with a very deep grounding in morality?
With very deep grounding in morality. I think probably not. I think that every person that I have known who exhibits lots of psychic energies tend to use them in very human ways, for good and sometimes not for good. And that the people I know of who I would regard as the most moral human beings tend to be people who would never deliberately flaunt or attempt to publicly use psychic functioning in any way at all or be associated with it. Now that I think about it, and I have to say, I don't remember anybody quite asking me that question before, but I think it's basically true that the people I know who are of the highest ethical standings don't even want to be associated as being healers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they might do healing, but they wouldn't want it to be associated with their person in some way, because the identity of being a healer can be itself a distraction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder how tricky that process of staying non-identified with the capacities that come to you, how it can be so easy, I guess, to think of oneself as like, I am the healer, I am the, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's necessarily bad. I like the idea that people are willing to be responsible when these things occur. There is this notion in parapsychology of that when you attribute these abilities to some sort of other agency, like God, or like it's my guardian angel, or my guardian spirit, or it's the spirit realm, or it's something that's not me, it's a way I think that most people who get involved in psychic and spiritual work operate, because that way the ego is, you eliminate all the problems of claiming that you're doing it yourself and that your ego attached to it. On the other hand, there is perhaps a need to be responsible and not always to pass the responsibility off on, for example, when I work with the ETs, many times negative things would happen. And when they did, Ted Owens would say, I didn't do that. That was the ETs who did it. So the funny thing is, I guess, as I mentioned before, no matter what words we try and put on it, or what language, how we attempt to dress up whatever we're doing in the most exalted way we might possibly want to think about it, there's always going to be a darker side to things. That human nature is just that way. We all have a shadow side. We all have a dark side, and it has a way of insinuating itself into everything we do.
That's a grounding reminder to hold as we explore these themes. I'm going to go on to our next caller here.
Yes, Jeffrey. Thank you very much for the conversation that's going on. You said you were a Sagittarius in some context, and that kind of prompted something for me to ask you. It could be sounding like a blank question that someone's asking, or it could be something like someone's asking to give a blank check, or sign a blank check. Given that you have interest in things like forecasting systems, and given that you have been involved with the paranormal and a whole lot of other disciplines, and also an understanding as to what's going on maybe within the country or within this planet or maybe even otherwise, what would you be intuiting or what would you be feeling as to what is coming up in the short term in time?
You would like to know my intuitions about things that we're likely to experience in our own lifetime.
Yes.
My intuition is this. We're living in an extraordinary time. Humanity is faced with responsibility that we have never known as a species for the entire planet, because we now have the capability of destroying it. And in fact, we're in the process of doing exactly that through global warming, through the pollution of the planet, through the mass extinction that we're in the middle of right now, of species dying as largely as a result of human activity. And we're called upon to jump to another level somehow if we're going to address these problems. Otherwise, the human race is very likely, and this is, I'm not even thinking short term, because the human race can survive for thousands of years while it declines. But my concern is that in spite of wonderful scientific advances, there's a certain amount of decline going on in the human race right now, that we've been through major wars, and there's no reason to think that we're immune from future wars. I think that we can expect in the future catastrophes, to be quite honest, that we're seeing it right now with hurricanes, that they're going to be, global warming is going to lead to more flooding, that there's going to be population expansion and a limitation on available resources. Much of the world doesn't have enough water. All of these things are triggering political developments that are very authoritarian in nature, that different governments seem to be feeling that you just can't, that democracies seem to be incapable of addressing the problems that people are facing, and so people are looking for other non-democratic alternatives, and frankly those alternatives at the moment don't seem to be very good. So I'd say we're in for a lot of chaos, to be quite honest, and the very future of humanity is in doubt, and this is a very crucial time for the future of humanity. And we have a lot to account for.
Now, while I hear you, is the solution, or I don't even know what the solution is, but one of the reasons that I kind of feel is this so-called you versus me, or there is the you and then there is the me. And in this sense, we have the so-called 7 billion and odd so-called people, and then there are these other life forms. Now, is it that there are so many of these that are resisting or refusing the common poor that might be out there in the collective consciousness that is contributing to this foreseeable chaos?
Because people are resisting the pull to come together.
That's right.
Yes, I think so, because we're at a point where humanity really needs to unite at a planetary level in order to address the problems that we face. And there are many, many people who believe that this is a very dangerous thing, that it means the New World Order, that it means that whatever attachments we have to the old way of doing things, where certain ethnic groups were on top or certain ideologies were on top, that's all changing, and people find that very frightening. And the truth is, humanity may not be up to the challenge that we face on this planet, and we may go down. We may end up destroying ourselves or making things just worse and worse and worse, and people of higher consciousness may be incapable of stopping that trend. And I think we have a lesson that we can learn from great literature in this case, because the greatest of literature in the English language is, to my thinking, the literature of tragedy. And it's how do people cope with things when you're in a tragic circumstance where, you know, for all we know, the greatest tragedy would be the destruction of humanity itself. And maybe that's what we're witnessing, for all we know. But it's still incumbent upon each of us to rise to the level that we can to address that situation, so that even if all is lost and that circumstances are completely tragic, we know that we are doing everything we can to be the best people that we can be, to live the highest and most noble life, regardless.
Beautiful. Thank you, Devin, for that question. We are getting close. This call has flown by. Angela, I wanted to ask if you had any final questions that you had for Jeff before we close out.
I just so appreciate the questions of the callers and your questions. And I feel with that last sharing, it brings me back to the subject of forgiveness and the energy of forgiveness. And I wonder how forgiveness... it makes me just want to be more forgiving, and I do wonder about the energy of forgiveness in relationship to renewal and possibility. And it's just been an amazing call and full circle, and I just thank you, Jeff, from the bottom of my heart. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure to be with you.
We have one final call that we do ask all of our guests, Jeff, and that is, what can we as the service-based Awaken Call community do to support and further your work and the spirit behind it in the world?
Well, I would encourage people to visit the current website that I have. It's New Thinking Allowed, ALLOWED, it's all one word, .com. And that is the video channel that I've been operating on YouTube for the last 2 years, and there are, just in the last 2 years, hundreds of videos representing what I think are the deepest and wisest and most knowledgeable people working in the fields of parapsychology and consciousness.
Beautiful. We'll definitely send that link out to all our listeners. And as you look forward to kind of the path ahead, What are you focused on in this time?
Well, I'm actually addressing political issues right now, because it seems as if, I think as I mentioned earlier, one of the guests who has been on the program 9 times and done extremely well is being accused of being engaged in alt-right and white supremacist and neo-Nazi activities. This is a person whom I regard as having very, very high humanistic values and is being attacked from by people who share my own progressive politics, because, you know, once you get labeled as a neo-Nazi, it's like you're beyond all redemption. And I think that's wrong. So I've been fighting a battle about that and attempting to kind of expand the interviews that I've been doing on philosophy, psychology, health, science, and spirituality to add in an element of politics as well.
Thank you for doing that work and taking that personal and public stance that you have, and for all the work really that you've done over the decades. It truly has enriched not just this call but our world. So thank you so much. We end, as we began, with a minute of silence. And at the end of that, we will unmute all our callers so they can join us in a collective and chaotic thank you, chorus of thank yous. We'll take a minute of silence in gratitude for all that was shared on this call. On the count of three, we will say thank you, Jeff. One, two, three. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.